Luke chapter 23, beginning in verse 33. When they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And the people stood by, looking on, and even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." Now there was an inscription above him, "This is the King of the Jews."
Yeah, I've this morning listened to the reading of two different accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus. We have participated in the Lord's Supper, and we just sang, and I appreciate Andrew leading that song for me, "Make Calvary Real to Me." In our study of the cross this morning, I want us to consider some of those in the scriptural account for whom Calvary was very real indeed. And the first of those is one who was not there actually at the cross, though he should have been, and that, of course, is Barabbas. Before ever Jesus was crucified, there were three crosses already prepared. The soldiers were ready to crucify three men. Barabbas would have been on that third cross, except it was a custom of Pilate to give to the Jews one of their captives and to appease the crowd in that way. Instead of asking, as he presumed they would, for Jesus, they asked for Barabbas. And so Barabbas, who should have died on the cross, who was scheduled to die that day, who was guilty of crimes worthy of capital punishment, did not die, but Jesus did. And you can be sure that Calvary was very real indeed to him. When we use the word Calvary, of course, that's one of the transliterations from the Latin version, which is translated skull. So in the reading that Tim did, he read about the skull, but in the King James Version, it would talk about Calvary there, as we sang about in the song. But for whatever name it's called, whatever name it was called in the Aramaic or the Greek of the day, it is clear that Barabbas knew very much what was happening on that day. In many ways, of course, Barabbas is a representative of the substitutionary death that Jesus died on the cross for us. Barabbas was guilty. Jesus died. Barabbas was a notorious robber. He was really a murderer. He had led a mob on a pillaging expedition. The Romans had caught him. They had determined that he deserved to die, and they were prepared to put him to death. And yet he did not die for the sins that he had committed. Jesus died, really, a murderer's death in his place. It's really interesting, too, that Barabbas means the son of the father, Bar Abbas, the son of the father. And that's at least ironic, if not prophetic, because Jesus is really, is he not, the son of the father. In so many ways, then, Barabbas is a demonstration to us of the substitutionary death of Jesus on the cross. So you think for a moment about how real Calvary was to him. He had waited through the past days and certainly through the past hours for certain death. And now here come the footsteps, the keys rattling in the lock, the gruff voice of the soldier saying, "Come with me." You're being released. Why? Because some guy named Jesus is being crucified in your place. And what might he have wondered about that? Bewildered, surely, but relieved, certainly, that he would have another chance at life. And I wonder about Barabbas if the preaching of the gospel ever came to his ears. And if the preaching of the gospel came to his ears, did it ever bring home to him the fact that Jesus had died in his place? And would that have made, did that make a difference in his life? I'm almost certain anyone who gets that close to death and then is relieved of death is going to have some pretty strong emotions. And they're going to have a kind of an opportunity to reevaluate their life. I don't know what Barabbas did with that opportunity, whether it changed his life permanently. More likely, of course, temporarily he would have been a changed man, but then he would have slipped back into the same old lifestyle, unless he had met Jesus personally through the preaching of the gospel. And of course, because Barabbas really demonstrates to us the substitutionary death of Jesus in our place, we might well wonder about ourselves. What is the effect that the death of Jesus in our place has on us? For he died for us and in our place as surely as he did to Barabbas. Make Calvary real to me. There were others who were there at the cross and who saw it, who participated in it, who saw the dying man on the cross, who saw the blood dripping onto the ground. They were there. The soldiers, in fact, who participated in the nailing of his hands and the nailing of his feet to the cross. And probably these soldiers were brutal, callous, and indifferent to what took place around about them. I don't know where they started, what kind of men they were when they were put onto this kind of a job, but you can't do work like that without it having an impact on you. At one point, of course, they were small children, innocent, as all small children are innocent. But by now, they are, in fact, living their lives looking down, living their lives like pigs who root under the apple tree for rotten apples and never look up and see the glory of the tree or the living apples that are above them. I don't know if they really ever looked at Jesus. They had crucified other men before, and it had always gone the same way. Maybe the first time they were involved in this, they were filled with sympathy and anguish about what they were doing. But after a while, you just don't look. I don't know if they looked at Jesus, but Jesus did look at them. We talked about that last week and how he looked at them, not in anger or in loathing as the previous people they had crucified had probably looked at them, but he looked at them with a strange look of love. And he said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." Even then, they divided his garments by casting lots over them. Did they hear what he said? If they heard what he said, did they understand the implications of that? Did they understand who this man was that was being crucified? We might well ask ourselves the same question. Because in the way in which he died on the cross in Barabbas' place, when he prays to the Father, "Forgive them, they know not what they do," in some ways he is praying for us at that very moment as well. His request was as much for us as it was for them. And though we might despise the soldiers and justify ourselves in comparison, we've never been involved in that kind of brutal activity before. Surely we would be more compassionate than they. Still, in some ways, we are much closer to them than we are to Jesus, who died on the cross in our place. His compassion and his purity, so far above our own that the difference between us and the soldiers diminishes to almost nothing. We need his prayers for forgiveness as much as the soldiers. It was a real occasion to them. How significant, I don't know. It ought to be real to us and significant to us as well. There was one of the soldiers who stood out above the others, and that, of course, is the centurion. In Mark chapter 15 and verse 39, we read about the centurion who was in charge of this guard. And he stood opposite him, we're told, and he saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last. And the centurion said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Here's the man who commanded the callous soldiers, but he was not like them. He was a cut above them, it seems. He lived in a world of brutality and of drinking and undoubtedly worse. Here, the men that he was in charge of were gambling over the clothes of the man they were crucifying. He was not involved in that. He watched, he looked, he saw, and to some extent he understood what he saw. He was not immune to the evidence of the world in general, that there's something better, there's something more to life than just this drinking, brawling, getting by with whatever you can get out of life that his soldiers seem to have. He had some sense we're made for something better. He had some sense that there is something more important than just the things and the affairs of this world. He had some idea that there was a God who was looking out for mankind. A lot of people have that feeling vaguely, but they confuse it oftentimes with a desire for more money or more fame or more power or even more pleasure, maybe of just a more refined kind than that which the soldiers sought. But none of those things really ever are finally satisfying. The centurion had come to a realization that there was something missing in his life. He knew somehow vaguely about God and the need that we have for an association with God. And he saw this man, and he knew this man was not like other men that they had crucified. This man, given the things that were occurring all around about, this man, given the way he conducted himself there on the cross. And maybe this centurion was aware of the things that had been going on this week in Jerusalem, aware of the situation that surrounded his trial and his conviction. This man was brought to faith. And he said, surely this was the Son of God. And we may hope, based on that, that his life was changed by this crucifixion. We have no further evidence about that, but it can't help but be that in some ways he was changed, whether he went on from there to full and complete faith in the Lord and service to him, we cannot know. But there are some things we learn about life from this centurion. We learn this: you can't really continue in a world of brutality and sin and expect that it will leave you unchanged. You have to do something. You can't just keep going down that same path or you will end up like those soldiers. You have to denounce what you see around about you. You have to speak out and you have to say, surely this man was the Son of God. This life over here is not what's worthwhile. This is sinful and wrong. This man is right. If we don't do that, then we get sucked back into the morass of the world. There's an old story about a man who tried to save the city of Sodom back in the days before it was destroyed by fire and brimstone. And he went about all the time saying, you've got to stop this. Like a Jeremiah for Sodom, he proclaimed, repent, the end is coming unless you repent and turn to God. Nobody had listened to him, of course. Our account, brief as it is, about Sodom would convince us nobody is going to change those people's mind. And they said to him, why are you bothering everybody? You can't change them. And the guy's response was, well, maybe I can't change them, but I still shout and scream to prevent them from changing me. If you don't speak out against what is wrong, no matter the fact that you may not change anybody else, if you don't speak out, then you can't help but being changed by what is wrong in the world. Unless we want to be changed by the brutal, sinful world in which we live, we have to speak out and we have to keep screaming and shouting and saying, that man was the Son of God. Or else we get sucked back into the same morass of the world. Centurion was given an opportunity and he saw and he believed. And he proclaimed, at least on this occasion, that Jesus was the Son of God. And what about us? Is it real to us as it was to him this man is not like everybody else. This man was the Son of God. Around the cross, too, there were the priests, the scribes, the high priest even. You know, I don't think we ever really sufficiently think about that term, high priest. These are the people that you don't really see in ordinary affairs of life. They are the high priest. You may see the priest on a regular basis, but not the high priest. Not everybody got to speak to a high priest in their lifetime. Not everybody got to even come close to a high priest in their lifetime. And these priests, these scribes, these high priests, they have all the advantages. They're not like the soldiers. The soldiers have been brutalized even as they've been brutal. They have very little education, probably, and very little knowledge of the world. They know very little about the scriptures, about the God of the Old Testament. These priests, they know all of those things. They know the law. They have an education. They have the leisure to think and to consider, to send and ask questions of Jesus when he was preaching. They're in that position to inquire and to understand. But alas, they love the status quo. They are, after all, the high priest. They are fat and they are contented and they're not really interested in a revolutionary kind of a change in the relationship with God, no matter that it is a better covenant, as the Hebrew writer extensively demonstrates. And they got him crucified. But that wasn't enough. They were there. They were there. Mark 15 tells us. In Mark 15 and verse 31, likewise, the chief priest also together with the scribes mocked and said among themselves, he saved others, himself he cannot save. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross that we may see and believe. You just can't even hardly imagine. Filled with such envy and hatred and spite, that once they had successfully, as they thought, gotten him out of the way, they had to go and mock. They are even more ugly and despicable than the soldiers. And maybe in some ways, when Jesus looks at the soldiers and says, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. There's a distinction made between them and the high priest, who know exactly what they're going to do. Truth of the matter is, though, they're like the soldiers. They didn't start that way, but they'd made themselves that way by getting used to power, by getting used to having their own way, by getting used to thinking that they were important, by their unwillingness to let Jesus into their lives. Ultimately, here they are at the sight of a crucifixion, can you believe it? Shouting and mocking and blaspheming. And Annas in particular, to me, seems like an amazing something. He's the most sinister face of all, it seems to me, more even than those brutal soldiers, more even than those priests, more even than the crowd that he's recruited. He's manipulated the whole situation. As the high priest, as the father of the high priest, it's his duty to defend the innocent and to punish the wicked, but he'd reversed the order. He let the wicked go, and he's punishing the innocent. And he did so not because he was mistaken, but out of envy he did so. They say it takes one to know one. And Pilate said it's envy. That's what's the reason for their betrayal of Jesus. Pilate knew the depth of the depravity of these high priests. And really, in some ways, Jesus remarks on it too in John 19 and verse 11 when he's standing before Pilate and having that conversation with Pilate. In John 19 and verse 11, he answered him and said, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin. And of course, it was Judas that delivered him, but that's not who Jesus is thinking about. Judas had delivered Jesus for money, but somebody had conceived that plan. Somebody had gotten the money to pay for Judas's betrayal. Somebody had worked out the details of it. Somebody had distorted the Sanhedrin so they would convict an innocent man who obviously was innocent. Somebody bullied the governor into crucifying Jesus. Somebody manipulated the crowd to go along to manipulate the governor. And that somebody was Annas. They took him to Annas first. John 18 and verse 13, we're told. They took him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. In Acts 4 and verse 6, Annas is called the high priest. And the truth of the matter is about Annas, he is a politician in the worst sense of the word. You think we got bad politicians today? Nothing like this guy, Annas. He was an impeached high priest, and then he manipulated the political situation with the Romans so that he got five of his sons named high priest and a son-in-law. And yet he was the real power in Jerusalem. You don't even want to think about the kind of machinations it takes in this kind of political situation to get five of your sons and a son-in-law named a high priest, supposedly serving in the temple of the holy God. But this guy did it. By now, he's about 70 years old, and if he's ever going to get old enough to know any better, it would have been by now, but he doesn't seem. He seems to get worse with age instead of better. He's more conformed in his sin now than he had been when he was younger, it seems. You think when you get close to the end of life, you might start to worry a little bit about meeting God, but not this guy. He's just as greedy, just as arrogant, just as envious as he had been before in his opposition to God, in his opposition to God's Son. And foolishly self-confident that he's going to win. And there Jesus is on the cross, and he sees it, and he mocks, and he blasphemes, and he challenges him. If he wants us to believe, come down from the cross, because he thinks he has won. But we know better. The old saying, there are no atheists in hell, surely applies to Annas. He knows now that he lost on that day. He may be the worst, but he's not alone. He has the crowd with him. And I'm not certain that this crowd that surrounds Jesus on that day is the same people who shouted Hosannas on Tuesday. But knowing how fickle crowds can be, I don't doubt that some of them were in both of those groups. But lest we be too hard on them, you think about how disappointed they must be. At the beginning of the week, they sounded hosannas. They laid out the palm branches. They thought that Messiah had come. They thought the new descendant of David would reign on the throne of David had come. They thought the time had come to raise an army and to do away with the Romans. And how disappointed they must have been when Jesus did not accept their plans. When he didn't gather an army and he didn't go to battle against the Romans, but instead he allowed himself to be captured and tortured, and he sure doesn't look like a king now, beaten and bloodied and exhausted and hanging on a tree. Out of just sheer disappointment, some of them could have been manipulated into yelling, crucifying. And of course, some of them would have rejoiced at how low he had been brought. When so recently he was so highly praised, there's nothing that we like so much as to see the high brought low. And some surely thought that. Or maybe there were among them those who were pleased that the moral demands of his teachings were now unenforceable. Or at least so they thought. And of course, there's the mere fact that they were part of a crowd. And whoever started it, there were others who just followed along because that's what everybody was doing. We're only too aware, I think, of the popular opinion, of peer pressure, of going along with the crowd. Paul warned us against that in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33. Don't be deceived, he said. Evil companions corrupt good morals. You associate with the crowd around the cross. You don't stand up and speak out against it, and you get sucked into it. It was real to them. There were some who were made better by the cross being real. In the passage that Greg read a moment ago in Matthew chapter 27, You read about the man who responded when Jesus cried out, "I thirst." And he was moved by Jesus' discomfort. And he gave him a drink. And two things stand out about that. One is the cry of anguish. When people cry out in anguish, it really brings out a need for some action in most of us. We sympathize when people are in pain. We don't like to be around people in pain because it makes us feel bad. We feel it inside ourselves. The old King James translation has that phrase, the bowels of mercy. The bowels of mercy. And you felt it too when you see a crippled dog dragging its way across the road and you feel it deep inside. And here, this man is in incredible suffering and he cries out in anguish, and most people would feel some sympathy for that. There's some people who can't feel sympathy for others. We call them sociopaths. But the rest of us, the overwhelming majority of us, we feel with other people. But we don't always help when we feel. Sometimes we just turn away, shut our ears, find something else to do, something else to distract us from that. So the other thing you note here is not only the cry of anguish that we all would recognize if we were there and we heard it and saw it, but the fact that one man acts. One man does something. Why not the others? They all had their excuses, I'm sure. My name's not Elijah. I'm sure that was a good one. He's calling on Elijah. Where's their Elijah here? My name's not Elijah. Others say he deserves to suffer. They wouldn't be crucifying him if he weren't guilty of something. It's none of my business. Don't want to interfere with the soldiers. Well, why in the world were they there looking on if it wasn't any of their business? I wanted to. I really was, but it was such a lost cause. He was going to die anyway soon. One drink of water is not going to make any difference. Or maybe the best one of all, somebody else will do it. But somebody did. One man acted. And who is he? And why did he act when nobody else did? Surely he saw, as they did, how little he could do. Surely his name was not Elijah. He saw how little he could do, but he did see the little that he could do. And he did it. And I doubt if he thought of it as a great thing when he did it, any more than the women who washed Jesus' feet thought it was a great thing when they did it. Or the woman who gave the two mites at the temple thought it was a great thing when she did it. But they are noted by God, and their tales are told, and a lesson for us perhaps too. When we see the little thing that we can do, no matter how little it may be, we ought to do it. Jesus saw the widow who put in the two mites, and he saw the women who washed his feet, and he saw this man too. I don't know how much longer this man lived. I don't know really what his state was, but at least there is this to his credit, that when he enters death, he has this remembrance throughout his life and to his credit. And I wonder a little bit, you know, when Jesus months before had said, "A cup of cold water in my name given," thought perhaps just momentarily about this man and what he would do. And I don't know to what extent good deeds are going to make a difference when we come to judgment. It's clear that we all need the death of Jesus and his blood to forgive us of our sins. But Matthew 25 sure does make a really, really big point about the good deeds that we have done in this life being a basis on which the sheep and the goat are separated. And in fact, remember how it is? He says to those sheep when he says, "Enter into the blessedness prepared for you for the foundation of the world. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat, and I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink, and I was a stranger and you invited me in, and naked and you clothed me, and I was sick and you visited me in prison." This guy, this nameless man gave Jesus water when he was thirsty. These people, when they're told that, say, well, when did we do that? When did we do that? When you did it for the least of these, of course. But this man did it for Jesus in his direst need. He can remember that. And with what remembrance do we go through this life? With what remembrance do we enter into heaven? It was real to him. And it ought to be real to us as well. And time would fail me to speak about some others at the cross, to speak of the thieves on the cross, to speak of the women who were there through the whole horrible ordeal, to speak of John who was there. But there is one other group that I think I ought to at least spend some time on this morning, and really the whole reason that this lesson's prepared. And that's, what about you and me? What effect does the cross have on us? How real is Calvary to me and to you? These people were profoundly affected by Jesus and by Calvary. Some were so twisted they became worse. Others were moved closer to God by his pain and his suffering. I read a book a long time ago, kind of vaguely stick in my mind over all of these years, and the internet is wonderful. I spent 30 minutes, and I was able to find. The name of it is The Shape of an Illusion, a short 120-page novel by William Barrett. And it's a novel about a medieval painting that is found in modern times buried in the deep rubble, and is burned around the edges as somebody deliberately rolled it up and threw it into the fire to destroy it. And when they unroll it, it's a painting of the crucifixion of Jesus with the crowd howling at him and the soldiers that are there attending to his crucifixion. And the thing about the painting is that when you look at it for very long, what you begin to see is your eyes are attracted to one figure, some to one and some to another. And you look at it and it becomes familiar. And you recognize, distorted though it is by anger, that it is your own face. And no wonder people wanted to burn that painting, because we don't want to think about it that way. But the truth of the matter is, there we are at the cross because of us, of you and me, just as surely because of Judas or Annas or the soldiers. He died on that cross. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 21 says, he made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And Peter in 1 Peter 2 and verse 24, he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds we are healed. We're going to sing in just a moment Ray Overholt's hymn, I'm the One. I was not on that hillside when he gave his life that day. I did not nail his precious hands or take his robe away. I could not do a single thing to hurt God's only Son. But every time I sin on earth, I feel that I'm the one. I'm the one who shouted crucify. I'm the one who made his cross so high. I'm the one who stood and watched him die. What have I done? I'm the one. We ought to feel that way. We ought to feel it as keenly as those Jews did when Peter preached to them on the day of Pentecost. You remember what he said at the climax of that sermon in Acts chapter 2 and verse 36? Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. And they were pierced in their hearts and they cried out, men and brethren, what must we do? And he told them, you need to come even closer to the death of Jesus. Repent and be baptized. And baptism, we find out later, is into the death and the burial and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We ought to feel it as keenly as they did. And let's hope we respond as positively as they did when on that day 3,000 were baptized. because the cross was real to them, because they knew that they were the ones that Jesus had died for. If you're here this morning and you need to respond to the invitation of Jesus Christ as they did, we encourage you as we stand and sing this song.